Today's episode is brought to you by Atoms. They make up everything. Welcome to episode one of Wait, What Just Happened? I'm Terrence Pinkston.
And I'm Bailey Riddle.
Later in the show, we're going to have an interview with Sydney Mook, a reporter from the Grand Forks Herald, on the responsibility of big tech and the freedom of speech. Before we jump into the show, Bailey, how was your week? Is there anything that you got done that you wanted to accomplish?
Oh my goodness. Like, it's thinking about it, it sounds like such a small win, but I cleaned my house for the first time since Thanksgiving. And like, if you know me, I clean my house every single weekend, but I've just been so busy with work and the holidays, and like, I've cleaned here and there as I've gone, but like, it's not all been cleaned at the same time since Thanksgiving. So that was my win, was getting everything done this weekend.
It's really the little things that count, isn't it?
Yeah. And like, honestly, it put me in such a good state of mind, because I hate clutter. So like, staring at all the things piling up on my dresser, like it was stressing me out. So I am feeling much better.
It's a good way to de-stress. Clean your house and, you know, it helps with your state of mind. So awesome. Yeah, I guess mine was more centered around work. I got my boss was off this week, so that was nice there. But there are some personal things that I wanted to get done at work that I had the time to be able to do. So I did get all of them done, and I can't wait for the feedback on those particular things. So it was great. And I mean, at home, that's a whole different story. a major accomplishment this week, though, for me at home would be maybe getting this podcast off of the ground. I know it's something that that we've been working on for quite a while, and we recorded the pilot a few weeks ago, kind of fine-tuned some things, and here we are now recording our very first episode. So I call that a win.
Absolutely. I mean, this has been in the talks for a while, so we're doing it, and we're getting on the ground running.
On today's episode, we will be discussing a disturbing male fashion trend, a flying Porsche, how unsolicited dick pics could land you in hot water in the state of Texas, what we would do if we could live for 200 years, and those were the days, COVID edition. It's a jam-packed first episode. But okay, before we get to all of that, can we talk about the Chris Evans rumors that were flying around the internet over the past couple of days?
My goodness.
That's one way to start it, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I heard that he was potentially coming back as Captain America in future Marvel movies. And Cap is my favorite. Like, Chris Evans as Cap is just so handsome. He plays the role so perfectly. He truly is America's ass. And when I heard that he might be coming back, my heart just like soared. And what were your thoughts on it, Terrence?
Yeah, so Deadline had the exclusive. I actually found out through IGN's Twitter account, because that's where everybody went and blew up the internet on that day. But I mean, it's... I'm happy about it, but I mean, it's still really vague. According to the article on Deadline, we don't know if the deal is closed or not, but insiders say it's headed in that direction for Chris Evans to return as Steve Rogers in at least one Marvel property, with the door open for a second film. Sources add it's unlikely to be a new Captain America installment, and more likely to be what Robert Downey Jr. did after Iron Man 3, appearing in such films as Captain America Civil War and Spider-Man Homecoming. Marvel itself had no comment, and Chris Evans kind of really shrugged it off. He's like, hey, this is news to me, but you know, we know that this is something that has some value to it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we'll see him even come back in something like Falcon and the Winter Soldier on Disney Plus.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that would be good. So his story, we know the end game for his story, but this could be potentially whenever he went back and started his life with Peggy and all this other stuff. You see, there's a lot you can unpack with this. There's a lot that you can really dig into. Even, gosh, whenever he was fighting in World War II, you could even have something as simple as one of the missions. You could turn that into a film or some sort of a feature spot.
I feel like the vastness of the Marvel Universe really allows this to potentially be any number of things.
There's a lot of criticism where, again, the centers around the unknown, where people are worried that they're going to undo all the consequences of Endgame. But honestly, I have complete faith in the writers over at Marvel and how they would spin the story and really not ruin the integrity of the other stories.
Yeah, I mean, I think they know what they're doing. And for the most part, like, there's not been any major flubs or faux pas in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Everything is very consistent in a way that, even though there's different teams working on each separate property, everything still flows really well.
Well, it's going to be fun to see where they go with it over the next couple of years, because I imagine that it will be years before we see anything with Chris Evans as Captain America as sort of a new role or anything like that. So we will keep our eyes out for that. I'm excited.
Oh, I always keep my eyes peeled for Captain America.
I thought you were going to say, I always keep my eyes peeled for his ass.
I mean, that too. But, you know, his face isn't hard to look at either.
Well, there's a disturbing male fashion trend, Bailey, that's been circulating around the internet, and it's called a monkey tail beard.
I do not understand this.
I don't.
Why?
Why
would you do this to your face?
As a fellow beard connoisseur, I really don't get it. I do not understand where this is coming from. Like, I seriously can't stop laughing at this. It's the most ridiculous fashion trend that I've ever seen, and it's catching traction. I've never seen one in person before, though.
Yeah, I haven't either. And for those who are listening and who haven't heard of this monkey tail beard, basically it's a section of the beard is shaved off on one side of the face so that it's like clean shaven. And then the remainder of the beard coming from the other side is shaved in such a way that it looks like a monkey's tail is curving down along the jawline and up over the mouth, connecting with the mustache to be the end of the tail.
It looks like a J on your face.
Yeah, pretty much. And like, the only thing I can think of that's coming around is like someone started to shave their face and like only did a portion, and then they were like, huh, it looks like a monkey's tail.
Well, there was a baseball player, and I can't forget, I mean, I can't remember his name. I keep forgetting, but he played for the A's. And I don't know if he still plays for him, but this was maybe a year or so ago, and he did it as a joke, I think for one inning, but it caught on. And I'm just like, oh my goodness. I mean, I don't know if this would, I seriously don't know if this would be what within, you know, the acceptable grooming standards at some companies.
So what you're saying is you're not going to be rocking the monkey tail beard anytime soon.
I mean, I didn't say that, but like, I mean, I am tempted to try. I have to get clean shaven. I do have a pretty healthy beard growing right now. And I don't know. Maybe I'll do that. Maybe I'll throw it into the show notes and see.
I mean, if you're going to be shaving anyways, you might as well at least try it for a photo.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, see, usually whenever I shave, I'm like, oh, yeah, let me go ahead and try, you know, this different way. And this, and you really can't mess it up. Unless you're really going for something like you want to keep hair and you just kind of really screw that up. But you really can't screw it up whenever you're shaving. I just don't, at least I don't think you can.
Yeah, I had a teacher in high school who would, every time he would shave his beard, he would like do something funny with it for one day. So like, he'd come in and he'd have a Fu Manchu, or like he would only have a goatee. And so we never knew what to expect, but he would tell us, you guys, I'm going to shave my beard tonight. And so we knew to expect the next day coming in, he was going to have something ridiculous on his face.
There is some people that have gone as far as coloring this beard, this trend. There's I'm looking at a couple of pictures right now. I'll be sure to include this source link here in the show notes. But some of them have, like, they've just fermented, like, sections of it. And it looks like a cheetah or a cat's tail or something. They should have called it the cat's tail beard for, yeah. for some reason. But there's, yeah, I mean, it just looks ridiculous. Can we not make this a thing, please?
Well, and then they're going to start putting like glitter and like beard charms on their monkey tail.
Oh, my goodness. That's going a little far for me.
Those are a thing, too. So I hear. I don't know. I hate beards, so it's not anything I'm interested in.
Did you know that there's at least 27 different types of beard styles? I had no idea. I thought there was, you know, you got the full beard, you got the, you know, the chin strap beard, and then you got another whatever. And then I looked it up while I was doing research on this topic, and oh my God, there's a whole chart. And I was like, wow, like there's so many different styles. And I'm like, ooh, I want to try that one and that one. I'm all circling
yeah,
up.
Yeah, that's about 27 styles too many.
But yeah, maybe whenever I go to trim up, I'll do the monkey tail beard and post it on the Twitter account for y'all to see and include it in the show notes of this episode. Well, speaking of weird, our next story here, a family of nine spends 9 years, get this, 9 years, almost a decade in a basement waiting for the end of the world.
This sounds like some, oh God, what's the Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt? Like, that's some crazy stuff going on where you live in a basement and you come out just to see that things are extremely different than when you went in.
According to the article,
why would you do this voluntarily?
I know, right? According to the article on Newswave, the police of Dutch region Drenthe, yes, as the player, I guess there's a soccer player named Drenthe, has discovered this week a case that has brought hands to the heads of much of the public opinion of the country. In this rural area, a family composed of 58-year-old father and his six children lived in the basement of his farm where they had been apparently without contact for the outside world for 9 years, waiting for the end of the world, according to the first investigations of the police, which, however, is still not entirely clear about the reasons. I guess the only way that they kind of found out was, I mean, and this thing came to light, was because the eldest of the 25-year-old sons managed to leave the area and travel several kilometers to a cafeteria where he gave the alarm warning that his family was in a very bad state of health. He said he had run away and needed help. I had very long hair, dirty beard, very old clothes. I was very confused. So I decided to call the police to come and investigate what was happening. And I think there's a bit of a translation issue here with that quote, but he's referring to the young man that ran into, this is the cafeteria owner referring to the young man who ran into the cafeteria there. That, my first thought is like, what the heck? Like, what prompted them? I mean, there's people that do this. You have doomsday preppers and things like that, sure. But like, what prompted you to be there, be in this hidden place for 9 years? And secondly, like, didn't you really care about the health and well-being of the people around you? It's sad.
Yeah, and like, what happened 9 years ago to prompt these people to go underground?
Mm-hmm.
Quite literally. Like, what was going on in the world or in their country at that time that made them feel that was necessary, I guess, would be my first question.
Yeah.
I think the saddest part of this story, though, there's a couple more quotes in the article, that it says that when they searched the place, the agents found a hidden staircase behind a closet in the living room, which connected to a basement under the house where five teenagers were, and the father, who had suffered a stroke a few years ago and was prostrated in the bed. So, like, this man clearly needed medical help and either couldn't receive it because the children may or may not have known that the outside world existed, and didn't receive the help that he needed.
Yeah.
And The real kicker here is the children are all over 16 years old, but the family had had no contact with the outside world for 9 years, and some of the children did not know that there were more people living on this planet.
Yeah, really. Think of how much these children have missed out on over the past 10 years, because there's been a lot of stuff that have happened, that a lot of things that have happened in the past 10 years on this planet. And I'm just really shocked that they've kind of missed out on it.
Yeah. I mean, imagine going the majority of your life isolated from everyone except your family, and then discovering that there's literally an entire world out there of things that you've been sheltered from.
Yeah. Yeah. Very sad.
It's crazy. I would say they avoided the COVID-19 pandemic, but this article is from 2019, so they got out just in time to go into lockdown.
Oh, that's fucked up.
They're used to it. They're professionals at this point.
Oh, my goodness. Well, speaking of fucked up stories, here's the next one. A girl hands out cookies made with her grandmother's ashes at school. Yeah, this is a real story. And Bailey, this is from your neck of the woods. This article comes from KTLA.
Lovely. I'm so glad I didn't go to school with this girl.
So a Davis family, Davis, California, about 5 hours north of where you're from, is upset after their son came home and told them another student brought cookies to school baked with her grandfather's ashes and passed them around. And the incident has prompted a police investigation. The girl is going around telling everybody basically at this point that she had brought in these cookies to school with human ashes on them, or in them, rather. I wonder how many she was able to make.
First off, why would you ever put someone's ashes in any kind of food? Like, what was the, like, did she think it was flour? I don't know. Second up, does this count as cannibalism?
I some form, I can imagine. Did anybody get sick out of this? No, at least not according to the article yet. There's an ongoing investigation about this with the school, the police, and, you know, the student. But I don't know. I mean, I can't. The thought grosses me out. It really does. But is it detrimental to my health? Like, I mean, unless she just like poured the whole urn in there into the thing where she baked the cookies. And first of all, I want to know who helped her bake the cookies. That's my thing. You know, there's got to be somebody
this whole story is so strange.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm trying to look in here. I don't think it mentions how old the students are. It says it was a high school student. So, I mean, she could have done it on her own.
I'm just thinking back to that movie. I can't even remember what the name of it is. Or maybe it was a Family Guy episode where Meg, she cooks cookies for Brian and she puts her hair in there. Or no, it was pie. And she puts a piece of her hair in there and she goes, "A piece of me is now inside of you, Brian." And she goes, "Do you like me inside of you, Brian?" And I was like, that's all I can think about with this this story. Ugh.
It's just so wrong. And I don't know, like, I've never personally done it, but I know people who have like gone through cremated pets' ashes. Like, you know, you get it back from your vet or whoever's doing the cremation. And so I know a couple people who have like gone through, and it's not all like smooth and fine. Like there's little chunks of bone and whatnot in there. So
yeah,
like, were these crunchy cookies?
Oh, gross. The school district declined to interview, but they did put out a statement saying that while we cannot comment on confidential student matters, I can tell you that the physical and social emotional safety of our students is our first priority. We take all allegations of wrongdoing seriously, and we conduct thorough investigations and involve police when appropriate. When wrongdoing is found to have occurred, disciplinary measures are applied. At the same time, measures are taken to repair the harm within the community. This case has been particularly challenging, and we have responded appropriately and in the most respectful and dignified way possible. I imagine some kids are distraught over this. Parents, definitely.
Well, that's the thing. If you read the whole article, it mentions that the student who reported it to his parents, he had said something, or the school called him in for an interview and had him give a statement and sign it. And then they told him not to tell anyone, and his parents were never informed by the school or the district. So they were trying to keep this under the rug, it seems like.
Yeah. And again, in the article, it doesn't say if anybody had gotten sick. I don't believe anybody has. But still, a little disconcerting, to say the least.
Yeah, I don't think those cookies tasted good.
Sugar and... what?
Sugar and spice and everything.
Grandfather.
You don't want to eat.
Gross. Okay, so that's that. Our next story here is a Porsche crashing into a second story home. Yes, you read that, or I read that correctly. I had to do a double take on that. Cars don't fly. Cars don't fly.
Didn't you hear this was the latest collaboration between Porsche and Tesla?
Oh. I was expecting you to say, didn't you hear that this is the latest collaboration between the American School of Witchcraft and Wizardry and the Weasley twins?
Well, that could be too.
This did happen in New Jersey. An officer at the scene said that the Porsche was traveling at a high rate of speed. Skid marks could be seen on the eastbound side of the road heading towards the center median of the building, and the car landed upside down with its bumper landing on the front lawn. I don't understand how a car could get this high in a neighborhood.
This seems like something you'd see in a Fast and Furious movie. Like... They have cars do crazy things all the time. And I don't know, like, it's just so unreal to imagine that a vehicle could get out of control and propel itself into a second story building.
The two people that were inside the vehicle did die as a result of this accident. But I mean, it all comes down to the end user, right? And to the person that's actually operating the vehicle, because the vehicle is a deadly weapon if you so choose it to be. What I fail to understand is, I mean, this isn't the first story that we've ever seen either of a car crashing into a second story building. Like, how the hell are these cars getting up so high where they crash into a second story building, like through a window or something? I guess that's what I'm failing to understand.
It's got to be just a lot of momentum and coming into contact with something that propels it upward.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I love driving, and I have a little bit of a lead foot, if you will. I tend to go hard on the gas pedal. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, you have to be safe and you have to think about the other people that you're around when you're in a car. Like, it's one thing to put yourself at danger, but it's another thing to risk other people's lives.
All right. Our last news story here is sending unsolicited dick pics in Texas could land you in hot water. Actually, more than hot water. They are illegal now to send unsolicited dick pics in the state of Texas. I don't know.
Aren't you glad you're not dating anymore?
That's what I was about to say. Yeah. I'm glad I'm married. I mean, yeah, it could land you.
Well, and it's just unsolicited. Like, if you ask for them, that's still okay, right?
Yeah, right. But I could see people using this and putting a spin on it where they're like, oh, well, she said that, you know, she liked... barbecue and sausage, so I thought I'd send her a picture of my dick. I mean,
she wanted to see my eggplant. I didn't realize that she was talking about what I was cooking for dinner.
But sending an unsolicited dick pic could land you with a $500 fine and a criminal record. The state has introduced the new law, which means that sending someone a nude lewd to which they didn't consent, whether on a dating app, Messenger, or even AirDrop, is now illegal. Okay, so this says a nude...
Who AirDrops lewd. A nude to someone?
Can you imagine just like in a mall or something like that, or coming off of a plane and just turning to the people and being like, you're welcome. You're welcome. Yes, you're welcome. You're welcome.
I mean, I know you like to AirDrop podcast episodes to strangers.
I do.
Yeah. I'd honestly never even imagined someone would airdrop nude photos to someone. Just walking around. No, oh, here's a gift.
Electronic transmission of sexually explicit images or videos is considered a Class C misdemeanor in Texas. Of course, we just mentioned the fine of up to $500. Well, I can't say that I've ever gotten one myself, so there's that. I can't say that I would ever be inclined to send an unsolicited one out, so there's that.
Consider yourself lucky.
Oh, my goodness. There's a story in there.
I think every woman has stories like this, but I mean, when I was in college and, you know, on dating apps and you start to talk to someone and you feel like you might have a connection, and then all of a sudden you get a photo of their dick, and it's like, well, I didn't ask for this. Like, I get we were vibing, but I don't want to see what you got going on yet. I will let you know when I want to see what you have going on.
Like, that's a nice picture of your thumb.
Yeah, no, like, gentlemen, wait until they ask for the photo.
There you go. It's as easy as that.
Or ask them if they want to see a photo. That's an option, too. If they're not asking, you could say, hey, do you want to exchange some pics?
Oh,
at least in
goodness.
Texas, that'll keep you out of hot water.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay, well, let's move on to our next segment called In the Spotlight. And in this segment, we discuss what we would do if. Well, our question this week is, what would we do if we could live for 200 years? Okay, so there's a lot of history in 200 years. I would take my time and travel and see the world and not be in such a hurry to find a job or settle down. I would learn as much as I could about things that interest me. Not just things, like all things, since I would have a lot of time on my hands. Then I would try to figure out how the hell my body lasted 200 years without giving out.
Are you saying you've been hard on your body?
Oh, my goodness. That's an understatement. Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like what I would do is kind of very similar to what you mentioned. I really love learning in general, so I would like to be able to go to a college and get degrees in random fun things like literature or ancient civilizations. And I'm really into history, so I think it would be incredibly awesome to go to all of the museums and just see and experience the history of our world.
Yeah, no, that's true. Like I said, I'm a history nerd, and I mean, we'll talk about that later because there's something else that we're going to discuss involving history. But I would really soak up as much knowledge as I could without being in maybe a classroom or anything like that. I would just want to get out and experience the world and see it, and you know, and eat the food and taste the drinks and, you know, do all the kind of weird rituals and customs from, you know, different cultures and stuff like that. That would be very cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'd probably get a lot of reading done in 200 years.
I wonder how many books. I wonder how many books you could read. Okay. Hang on. Let's do a little bit of quick math, because this intrigues me. How many books did you read this past year?
In 2020, I read 200 books exactly.
Oh, wow. So, okay. Oh, that's right. Yeah, because you finished your 200th, just
because I finished
hours.
Four books on New Year's Eve. I skirted by the skin of my teeth.
Oh, my goodness. So if you read 200 books a year for 200 years, that is, oh, my God.
Well, you're not reading from year one, Terrence.
Okay, well,
you don't start reading straight out of the womb.
Shit. Okay, what about I don't know, 150 years? No, that's still too, that's too little.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, I feel like
190?
Personally, I really started reading a lot, I guess, when I was 13, when I went to high school.
Okay, 100,
I guess, would be when I started
187.
So, Yeah, 187.
Damn, that's still 37,000 books. That's more books that are in Bell's library. Jesus.
I'm like, that doesn't even... I just looked at 37,000 and was like, that doesn't even sound like a lot of books.
Oh my God. You have problems.
Seriously. I'm literally never going to read that many books in my lifetime, and it still doesn't sound like a lot of books.
Okay, our next segment is Those Were the Days, COVID edition. Now, we're going to kind of target what we are missing out on as we sit back and, you know, we're stuck at home and things like that. So some of the things we miss doing. And this week we're going to talk about travel. So where is it that we want to go the most right now that we can't go because of travel restrictions?
I have two answers for this question, because there's the one answer that's like always a given, and that's I want to go see Luke, my boyfriend who lives in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And we at this point have not seen each other for almost a year.
Mm.
Which has been incredibly tough, as people in long distance relationships can imagine.
Yeah.
But then, like, just travel wise like that aside, I really want to go to Scotland. Like, I have been fantasizing about a Scotland vacation for a really long time, and like, even last week I was like boredom shopping travel packages and seeing where I could go, even though I know it's probably at least a year off before we're traveling for pleasure and for sightseeing and whatnot.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, you really hit the nail on the head. And I mean, that's what I was going to say too, is I mean I want to go back to Europe. Specifically, I want to go back to the UK and Italy. There's a lot of things that I miss from these places, you know, the sights, the food, the culture in general. But Italy is probably the place where I've been longing to go. Venice and Rome are probably my favorite places in the world to go to. And like I said earlier, I love history, and there's just so much to see and so much to cover in those two cities that it's intriguing, you know. And the aesthetics in Venice, holy crap, the architecture in Venice is just beautiful. Not to mention Rome. Yeah, that's a completely different level. Those people were
crazy. Oh, it's so incredible over across the pond. Like, I mean, the United States has history, and we have buildings of significance like that too, but you go over to Europe and you see these buildings that are so old and have survived so much, and they're just so beautiful. And like, maybe it's because we don't see them that often living mm-hmm. in the United States. Like, there's a very different architectural style, but yeah, like, I just can't even imagine what it would be like to live in a country like that where you get to see that every single day. I'm sure you get used to it at some point, but I feel like I would be in awe every time I leave my house.
I would feel like it's something that never gets old for me, you know, just going to sit there on, you know, the Spanish Steps and, I don't know, really take in the sights, or go to the Trevi Fountain, or go to the Vatican, or, you know, see different things like that, or sit outside of a little cafe in Venice. I remember doing that and eating breakfast and having a cappuccino, and oh my God, or an espresso. It was just like, I was like, is this real? Is this real life? It was fascinating.
Yeah, no, that's one of my favorite things to do on vacation, is just to like go somewhere and try to experience things like a local, you know. I mean, I obviously want to go to the museums and some of the fun tourist traps, but it's also really cool to experience those small little cafes like you were talking about, and just kind of see what it is that the people who live there do on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. All right, before we get to our interview with Sydney on the responsibility of big tech and the freedom of speech, let's go ahead and give a couple of recommendations. And these are things that we're going to be recommending to you guys to try or to read if it tickles your fancy. I said that with an accent. That was pretty cool.
Man, you really want to travel somewhere, don't you, Terrence?
Oh, my bloody hell. I would just absolutely die. You know, the closest that I'm getting to traveling right now is like watching Bridgerton. That's as much as I'm... Yeah. My recommendation for you this week is a book called The 2020 Commission Report on the North Korean nuclear attacks on the United States. This is a speculative novel. It is fascinating. It is in a world where the coronavirus pandemic did not exist. Instead, something really horrible happened between North Korea, South Korea, and the United States. And it reads just like a commission report would to from to Congress about the findings of what actually happened. So there are a lot of intricate details, and it goes off of real-world actors, real-world players like former President Trump with Kim Jong-un and the Southern Korean president as well, and some of the government players in our federal government. And it is so fascinating. You guys can check it out on Audible. I will include a link to that, or on Amazon. That's where I got mine. So be sure to check
that
out.
That sounds like an incredibly thrilling read. Like that. Not that we want those things to have happened, but I think a lot of people would have preferred an alternate 2020.
yeah, exactly.
Keeping in the theme of thrilling things to read, I too have a recommendation for a book. It is titled Why Trump Deserves Trust, Respect, and Admiration by David King. You can pick this book up from Amazon. The little snippet on the back, it's a real gem, this book. It says, drawing upon exclusive interviews and exhaustive research, political analyst David King has compiled a complete and brilliantly accurate account of Donald Trump's virtues and qualities. This is a refreshingly different biographical masterpiece. And the very, very best thing about this book, when you open it up, it's entirely blank. So it's a great gag gift for the Trump hater in your life. It's a great gag gift for the Trump lover in your life if you don't ever want them to talk to you again. But this book just really tickled me when I saw it the other day. And I am recommending that everyone get it for someone in their life.
That's fantastic. I already put it in my cart on Amazon, so I'm going to be making that purchase later on this evening after we get through recording. That is so great. Like the guy is a genius for writing that book.
The description on this book on Amazon says, this book is full of blank pages. Despite years of research, we could not find anything to say on this subject, so please feel free to use this book for notes.
I also
it would make a really good notebook for a student.
That's very true. I would actually implore you guys to read the reviews on this book on Amazon. They're brilliant. Yeah, they make you laugh so hard. And remember, you can send in your recommendations to any of our social channels or by email to wwjhpodcast@gmail.com. Okay, coming up next, I have my interview with Sydney on the responsibility of big tech and the freedom of speech. All right, so today we are joined by Sydney Mook. She is one of our close friends and a reporter from the Grand Forks Herald in North Dakota. Sydney, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Me too. So let's jump right in, really, with the events of the past couple of years. Each and every one of these companies, of these social media platforms, seems to have taken on a life of their own. It's becoming much and more than each of the creators have intended and have ended up having a much larger influence on the world. Virality is now a part of our daily vocabulary and has lost so much of its punch over the years. The word itself just doesn't carry the same weight as it once did. Because of the saturation of these outlets and its users, going viral happens all the time for any reason. As a direct result, information and propaganda are spreading like wildfire. We've seen the real-world consequences of hate and disinformation and impact on lives. Other people lose their jobs, get arrested, they're doxxed in other ways, or see the true colors of brands. And the platforms themselves have two choices: to ignore it, act like there's no problems that exist, or to take action. And it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on, these platforms have been weaponized. So that leads us into the bigger conversation here. What does responsibility look like?
Yeah, I think that this is a really important conversation, especially just in the wake of everything that's been on. You look at the way that social media was used, the insurrection in early January, and you just look at everything else that was going on around that time and before and now. It's so important that when people are using social media as an individual, that you're using it responsibly, which means to me, you have to make sure that what you're putting out there is factual. You know, you can have an opinion, and that's perfectly fine. But I think that when you're sending out facts and tweets or Facebook posts, I mean, I think it's really important that you're being factual and you're being really responsible with what you're doing. Because I think the past few weeks have really shown what happens when things get out of control with incorrect information, with false information. And it can just continue to fuel more and more issues. And then it just kind of spirals out of control, right? So being responsible on social media is incredibly, incredibly important for a user.
Yeah, conversations and opinions or have ended up having sort of a snowball effect, right? They've built on one another to really where you get to some bat insane shit online. And I feel like the creators of these platforms that have the ability to self-regulate just have been letting the conversation go. And ultimately it's culminated to this, the platforms themselves have been weaponized to spread information and have collaboration take place between groups, and they start setting up for real world consequences, which we ended up seeing back on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol. That in itself, pushing the responsibility of having good conversations and thoughtful conversations and meaningful dialogue on these platforms has really been pushed off to the end user. Now, does the responsibility lie with the end user or with the big tech companies themselves?
I think that's a tough question, because to me, I think that every person is individually responsible, right, for what you're posting and what you're seeing online. But at the same time, I mean, these tech companies, I mean, you look at them and, start naming them off, like, Facebook and Twitter and Parler and all these other companies. But they also bear, I think, a lot of responsibility, because they should be keeping, in a lot of ways, their users in check. We saw a lot of discussion after the events of January 6th, and then the following few days after that, after platforms like Facebook and Twitter, it's essentially deplatformed Donald Trump, and people were up in arms about the fact that, they're taking away your First Amendment right. Well, it's not your First Amendment right to have a Twitter account. You sign when you sign up for a Twitter, you check a box that's, terms and conditions may apply. And at a certain point, they decided that they weren't following those terms and conditions. But at the same time, I mean, all of that had been going on far prior to January 6th, to the events that we saw that day, and people were forming these Facebook groups, and then they were getting together, trying to figure out how to get different places on Twitter. And it didn't seem like that was shut down quickly enough. But at the same time, do these platforms have enough people, or I'd be very curious, and I haven't done enough research on this to really know, but just the way that they all work, because I think that they had been, very well aware of what was going on their platforms, but then didn't probably take enough steps to stop it. I don't know. It's tough. I think it's a little bit of both, honestly.
So I think that they should be I think big tech companies need to understand how people are using their technology. And I think that there needs to be a level of responsibility with the way that people are using their technology, not just lie with the end user. Tech companies build in tools to these platforms and these devices to help make lives a little bit easier for people. They are not intending for people to use these devices or these platforms for the spread of disinformation and hate speech and, you know, things like that. I believe that their intentions are pure. However, that doesn't negate the fact that they are responsible for the way that people are using their devices, even if it's not as intended. I firmly believe that they have the ability to take some of those tools away, that they have the ability to self-regulate, that they have the ability to watch what's happening on the platform. And this will jump into like a whole other discussion. Well, if you can't watch and know what's happening on your platform, are you too big at that point? Do you need to be broken up into smaller, more manageable companies, or, you know, more laser focused departments to where, you know, you're able to watch what happens? And I understand that that may be difficult to do, but, you know, you have the ability, at least on the back end, to limit, you know, what people are saying, like choice words or something, you know, something like that, phrases. I mean, they have algorithms that should be able to detect that. But that gets into like a whole other discussion that, you know, about if these companies should be broken up or not. I want to get back to like the responsibility aspect of it with the end user. What about people with influence or power, such as celebrities or politicians that have millions of followers? You know, we've seen how fast information spreads, be it positive or negative. And look, I know that we're getting into the murky waters of the First Amendment now, but should the end user be held accountable directly by law enforcement for what they say or the actions as a direct result? Or is that more with the companies? Should they be held accountable for what happened on their platform?
Yeah, I think that's a tough one too, right? Like this entire like discussion is, I think, a delicate one and a really important one to be having. Because I mean, even if you look, you know, politicians and celebrities, people with these really big followings, I think have to be the most careful about what they are putting out there into the web universe. Because what these people say, you know, matters in a lot of ways, or they have enough influence that they can send a tweet and their millions of followers can then interpret that whatever way they interpret it, and then it kind of goes from there. I don't necessarily know if, you know, these people should be held criminally responsible for actions of other people, unless they are like directly like inciting violence, right? Like, you know, tweeting as such, or posting on Facebook, or, you know, whatever platform you're on, and actually inciting violence. Because then you just, I think you get tiptoed into waters that you shouldn't enter and everything like that. I mean, it depends on, you know, the way you're going with, you know, a trial or anything like that, anything in the courts. But, you know, at that point, though, I do think it would be the company's responsibility to step in and then to block that user so they can't, you know, continue to spread misinformation. I mean, you see that with when Twitter banned Donald Trump. I mean, I was just reading, I just pulled it up here again, that after they banned him from, and this is a story from Variety, they were pulling a Washington Post report. But it's saying misinformation about election fraud on social networks plummeted around 73% from 2.2 million to 688,000 posts, according to this social analytics firm.
Wow.
So that's from like Washington Post report. You know, that's incredible. That's, you know, one person effectively having a huge voice, especially as the leader of the free world, and constantly posting misinformation, then just caused it to just continue to spiral and fester. You know, by removing somebody like that from a platform, and it really, it does not matter if it is the president of the United States, if it is a celebrity, if it is, you know, whatever, if they've got a big enough following, it's gonna start to spiral. It does not matter what side of the aisle either that you're on in a lot of ways. But that's incredible. From 2.2 million to 688,000 posts over like a week's time. You know, I just thought that stat was insane. You know, just by removing one aspect of it. So, you know, I don't know if we should be holding people criminally responsible for the actions of others following a tweet. You know, that's tough waters to dip into. And I'm sure there'll be discussions that'll be had for many, many years from now, because, you know, disinformation isn't just going to magically go away.
Right.
But I think it's an important conversation to be continuing to have. How do people deal with the real life consequences of what goes on social media?
So we're going to talk a little bit about the First Amendment here, and I'm going to preface this next question with the First Amendment itself. And it says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Now, is the action that these companies are starting to take and have taken in the past couple of weeks, you know, banning accounts with hate speech and accounts that are spreading disinformation
and the users from these platforms, is that a violation of the First Amendment? And why?
It's not in my view, and I can almost understand why people think it is, right? Because it frankly, these are private companies, and again, when you're signing up for a private company, you know, you're following their terms and conditions. But I think it gets into, you know, and this is a really kind of a really big topic and probably something that could be its own separate conversation. But you really start to dip into what does the internet and social media landscape kind of just mean for how we interact as people now compared to, you know, even like the 40s or, you know, when the United States was founded and the Constitution was written. Like, I think it's a really interesting conversation. But ultimately, these are private businesses that are not, you know, freedom of speech does not come without freedom of consequence. So when you're tweeting and, you know, whatever, you know, misinformation, you know, that doesn't mean that there's not a consequence for that. You're also, again, you're on a private business platform. This is not a government run social media, which is something I don't think I'd ever want to see come to life. But, you know, I think it's going to be a really broad, like, important conversation that we're going to be having for a lot of years about at what point do these companies become so powerful that you start having conversations about, well, are you ever violating the First Amendment with these, you know, bans or whatnot? In my mind, no, they're not.
I've listened to a lot of tech podcasts over the years, and Leo Laporte, who is actually one of the inspirations for me getting into podcasting, has said the internet should be regulated like a utility, such as electric, water, etc. This means you will that you will have as a standard in your home, like pipes and cables, the basic infrastructure for broadband internet access. I know this opens the door to a whole other discussion, and I'm sure it's something that we're going to cover in the future. But for now, is it even reasonable to ask the federal government to fund and govern that's a very important aspect of this question, a world-class broadband network utility for everyone?
I don't think so, no. I would not trust something like that, or maybe not trust is the isn't the best phrase. But I don't think that's a slippery slope that I don't think that we're ready to go down yet. Ensuring that people do have access to the internet is super important, because it's just a part of our daily lives and just seems to be becoming more so as we, a lot of us have been working from home for the past, 10 months with this pandemic going on. And we see the importance of, making sure that families have access to the internet so that way their kids can, go to school. Being able to access the internet is really, really important, and there's still places, I know even in like North Dakota that it's still kind of hard to get access to broadband internet, but, local people can do that work to make sure that everybody has access to internet. It's just more of our daily life at this point, with schools and whatnot. But at this point, I don't find it reasonable to ask the federal government to fund and govern a broadband network. I think it's a really slippery slope to go down at this point. And maybe that'll be something that, sometime in the future we'll have one day. But at this point, I think that there's other ways to ensure that people have access to the internet in an affordable way. And you can have conversations about, if it should be kind of just treated more as a utility. But at this point, I don't think the federal government should be in the business of, internet right now.
And last question, it kind of springboards off of that. If the federal government had declared the internet a utility, I know this is a really deep question, and I'm just looking for a high level answer from this one, really, really basic. But what would that mean for the social media platforms? At least for me, what this would mean for the social media platforms, what I think it would mean, that they would be regulated to an extent of, if you promote hate speech, there are going to be consequences by the federal government. But at the same time, if the government deletes a tweet, one of your tweets, or deletes an account, that would be a violation of the First Amendment. And like I said, that opens the door to a whole nother discussion. But for now, the real basic high level answer would be that.
Yeah, I would agree with that at this point.
Very murky waters here, and social media itself has, of course, taken on a line of its a life of its own over the past decade, and it's changed. It's morphed into something that I don't think anybody could have imagined. And look, I'm a firm believer that it comes down to being responsible with what you post online. It's okay, like you said earlier, Sydney, it's okay to have an opinion, but at the same time, we all have that responsibility to be able to, promote healthy discussions, encourage healthy debate, and encourage positive dialogue and things like that. And I know that's asking a lot of people, a lot from people nowadays, but if we're ever going to get control of social media and retain that control in the direction of how the user just operates it, I think that's that's a great place for the end user themselves to start. Sydney, thank you so much for being on the show today. And if anybody wanted to follow you online or check out your work, where can they do that?
Yeah, you can follow me at Sydney_Mook on Twitter. And read, if you really have a hankering to read about North Dakota news, you can check out the GrandForksHerald.com. But I mostly, if you're going to follow me on Twitter, I mostly either am tweeting my stories or about sports. So enjoy.
All right, Sydney. Well, stay in touch and we'll talk to you soon. Well, a special thank you to Sydney for appearing on today's episode. And also a special thank you to my wonderful co-host, Bailey. It was nice to be podcasting with
shucks.
You again. Oh, shucks. Golly.
You shouldn't have.
If there's anything that made you go, wait, what just happened? Send it in to us at wwjhpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's wwjhpodcast@gmail.com. Be sure to follow the show on Twitter at wwjhpodcast and make sure you rate, review, and subscribe wherever you're listening. Well, we'd like to thank you so much for tuning in on this week's episode. Until next time, keep the dream alive. Hit your snooze button, yo.